they call the supracosmic, the cosmic and terrestrial, the supraterrestrial or otherworldly, and the integral or synthetic or composite. The theories that try to reconcile these three factors, or any two of them, which the other views tend to isolate, in this last category would fall our view of our existence here as a becoming with the divine being for its origin and its object, a progressive manifestation, spiritual evolution with the supracosmic for its source and support, the otherworldly for a condition and connecting link, and the cosmic and terrestrial for its field, and with human mind and life for its notice and turning point of release towards a higher and a highest perfection. Our regard, they must be on the three first to see where they depart from the integralizing view of life and how far the truths they stand or fit into this structure. In the supracosmic view of things, the supreme reality is alone entirely real. A certain illusoriness, a sense of the vanity of cosmic existence and individual being is a characteristic turn of this seeing of things, but it is not essential, not an indispensable adjunct to its main thought principle. In the extreme forms of its world vision, human existence has no real meaning. It is a mistake of the soul or a delirium of the will to live, an error or ignorance which somehow overcasts the absolute reality. The only true truth is the supracosmic, or in any case, the absolute. The Parabrahman is the origin and the goal of all existence. All else is an interlude without any abiding significance. Does somebody else want to continue from here?
Yeah,
it can. Oh, you don't need to continue.
Yeah, so Rosemary, you can continue.
Yeah?
Sorry, you can continue.
Yes, no
problem. Yeah, you can continue, sorry.
Do you want to continue?
Yes.
Okay, since I'm the new guy, I can continue for a little while to the end of the paragraph.
Sure, go ahead, Rich.
Please let me know if you can hear me okay. If so, it would follow that the one thing to be done, the one wise and needful way of our being is to get away from all living, whether terrestrial or celestial, as soon as our inner evolution or some hidden law of the spirit makes that possible. True, the illusion is real to itself. The vanity pretends to be full of purpose, its laws and facts. They are only facts and not truths, empirical and not real realities, are binding on us so long as we rest in the error. From any standpoint of real knowledge, in any view of the true truth of things, all the self-delusion would seem to be little better than the laws of a cosmic madhouse. So long as we are mad and have to remain in the madhouse, we are perforce subject to his rules, and we must make, according to our temperament, the best or the worst of them. But always our proper aim is to get cured of our insanity and depart into light and truth and freedom. Whatever mitigations may be made in the severity of this logic, whatever concessions validating life and personality for the time being, yet from this viewpoint, the true law of living must be whatever rule can help us soonest to get back to self-knowledge and lead by the most direct road to nirvana. The true ideal must be an extinction of the individual and the universal, a self-annulment in the absolute. The ideal of self-extinction, which is very clearly proclaimed by the Buddhists, is in Vedantic thought a self-finding. But the self-finding of the individual by his growth into his true being in the absolute would only be possible if both are interrelated realities. It could not apply to the final world-abolishing self-affirmation of the absolute in an unreal or temporary individual by the annulment of the false personal being and by the destruction of all individual and cosmic existence for that individual consciousness. However much these errors must go on, helplessly inevitable, in the world of ignorance, permitted by the absolute, in a universal, eternal, and indestructible avidya. And should we go on with the reading, or have we set the context?
Yeah, one more paragraph.
Okay.
You want to continue, Rich?
I can continue, but this idea of the total vanity of life is not altogether an inevitable consequence of the supercosmic theory of existence. In the Vedanta of the Upanishads, the becoming of the Brahman is accepted as a reality. There is room, therefore, for a truth of the becoming. There is in that truth a right law of life, a permissible satisfaction of the hedonistic element in our being. Its delight of temporal existence, an effective utilization of its practical energy, of the executive force of consciousness in it. But the truth and law of its temporal becoming once fulfilled, the soul has to turn back to its final self-realization, for its natural highest fulfillment is a release, a liberation in its original being, its eternal self, its timeless reality. There is a circle of becoming starting from eternal being and ending in it, or from the point of view of the Supreme as a personal or superpersonal reality. There is a temporal play, a game of becoming and a living in the universe. Here, evidently, there is no other significance of life than the will to the being to become, the will of consciousness, the urge of its force towards becoming, its delight of becoming for the individual. When that is withdrawn from him or fulfilled in him and no longer active, the becoming ceases. But otherwise, the universe persists or always comes back into manifestation. Because the will to become is eternal, and must be so since it is the inherent will of an internal existence, it may be said that one defect in this view of things is the absence of any fundamental reality of the individual, of any abiding value and significance of his natural or his spiritual activity. But it can be replied that this demand for a permanent personal significance, for a personal eternity, is an error of our ignorant surface consciousness. The individual is a temporary becoming of the being, and that is a quite sufficient value and significance. It may be added that in a pure or an absolute existence, there can be no values and significances. In the universe, values exist and are indispensable, but only as relative and temporary buildings. There can be no absolute values, no eternal and self-existent significance in a time structure. This sounds conclusive enough, and it seems that nothing more can be said about the matter. And yet, the question remains over. For the stress of our individual being, the demand on it, the value put on the individual perfection as salvation is too great to be dismissed as a device for a minor operation. The coiling and uncoiling of an insignificant spiral amid the vast circling of the eternal's becoming in the universe. Sorry, on 670 at the top.
Right. So this long, reading, which really to bring into context the turn, what might not call the turn of this chapter, which begins actually one paragraph before where we started. And it's a very, it's worth sort of bringing into our attention, what this turn is and where it's leading us. Because interestingly, in the passage that was read, one may even say that there is the actual seeds or roots of what one might call an actual mention of what one calls an integral theory. Now, this is a very controversial thing, because as we know, there's many people who are trying to formulate an integral theory today. In this particular paragraph, the chapter, Sri Aurobindo has gone through various other kinds of summaries or formulations before he gets to this point. These some summaries have to do with his statement of the structure of being and becoming. What is fundamental and what is derivative or derived from it? Where, three major terms, one may say, or four major terms that he has introduced. One of them is the absolute, or that which transcends all description. And he is basing his entire thesis, one may say, on the existence of something which is thus infinite and cannot be described, goes beyond even our ability to describe it as being. But the self-presentation of that, not self-representation, but the self-presentation of that as being is the first, sort of step, one may say, of a coexistence of the indescribable with the describable, or with the experienceable, with that which cannot be experienced, which can be bounded, that can experience itself, and that is being or Sachidananda. Now, being then has a property called becoming, and this becoming is a kind of a sort of going forth into time, as it. And so these are the three major sort of terms, and becoming becomes a derivative term on being, which itself is derived, or becoming becomes a representation of being, which is a presentation of the absolute. And then you find the individual, that's the fourth term, one may say, and the individual, even prior to talking about Schumann, etc., the individualization, the splitting or fragmentation of being into units, monads, if one might call it that, into which the focus of this absolute, becomes a kind of microcosmic reality, is a kind of a telescoping of the one into its own infinity. It's the coexistence of one and infinite. And this individualization evolves to a point where it recognizes, or it comes to a conscious formulation of its own identity. I mean, this is in a nutshell form, the sort of development that he has introduced prior to this. And in the process of that development, he has also introduced that fact that there is a kind of graded process involved, and the graded process relates to seven planes of consciousness. I mean, and he's introduced all these things before this particular phase in this paragraph. But having introduced this, which is basically a kind of a building of what he has already introduced way before, he comes to this turn in this particular paragraph. And that turn, it really pertains to what is the place of all this theorizing? You know, and there he makes the point that all this is just, you know, in letter, it's just on paper, unless it means something in experience. And if it is to mean something in experience, then the question arises as to how we are to relate this schema, this fundamental sort of, you know, structure to experience. And here he comes up with this whole notion of the four theories of existence, because he's saying that, you know, the importance of theories is basically in the fact that it is based on the structure that you inhabit that determines or defines the scope of your experience. So it is experience that really determines structure rather than structure determining experience. It is what your aim of life is, you know, and we discussed this earlier about the whole sort of life direction that really kind of governs our, our philosophies. That in that sense, there is a certain kind of choice we make with regard to what it is that we can experience, the scope of our self-experience. And interestingly, most people don't think about these things, but are given these things nevertheless. We absorb various, you know, discourses regarding what reality is, and that determines the scope of our experience, our aims and goals of life. But in our turning, the turning of individual consciousness towards a kind of a conscious goal of experience or realization, it is important to place our own philosophy as the, you know, as the kind of boundary of the boundaries of our experienceability. Now, this may change. It's in a sense just like science, where we may have a certain kind of a hypothesis, but in following it, our experience may actually direct us in other directions. And so, one thing we must realize is that in the life divine, he's constantly prodding the thought or ideas that he's introducing in terms of intuitions and experiences. That if this is a presentation that has appeared to us in history as some person's idea or thought about what reality is, to what extent is it, you know, sort of valid in human intuition and experience? And that he'll marshal other alternate forms of experience and realization, alternate sort of, you know, possibilities of experience, and say that, well, this is the place for that. So this is how he has proceeded so far. And at this point, he, after making that particular kind of case for the importance of a goal, a life goal, an experienceable life goal, it turns back to the whole idea about theories or philosophies or metaphysics, and sees them as inextricably, inseparably tied, and in a sense, secondary to the goal of experience. And this is where, without saying it, he's actually pulling on the Vedantic coexistence and relationship between yoga and darshana. So this needs to be understood. And then we see that he introduces these four, what one might call, theories. And it's interesting because this little paragraph that was read by Rosemary introduces the term or the seed of what one might call an integral theory. I read that part. These are the conceptions of truth of existence. These we may call the supracosmic, the cosmic and terrestrial, the supraterrestrial or otherworldly, and the integral or synthetic or composite. The theories that try to reconcile the three factors, or any two of them, which the other views tend to isolate. So here it is. We may think about these three major ones that he's presented And basically he's saying that to define the scope of our realization, we have to consider in turn these theories of existence, because that's what's available to us. And it's a very interesting thing what he's kind of claiming here, which is that the umbrella of the mind is what we carry with us wherever we go. And what that particular umbrella delimits is what we are going to experience. And so it's good to begin by understanding that and kind of, you know, sort of prodding it or poking it for arriving at the right umbrella. Now, the supracosmic is the first of the four, and the supracosmic is what he has introduced, the paragraph that was read. And there itself, he's actually splitting it into four different kinds of approaches to the supracosmic. The supracosmic is the absolute. The supracosmic is that which is beyond the cosmos, beyond all cosmos, beyond any becoming or representation or presentation. And so here, this would be one, and that would actually say that the absolute is the reality. And if the absolute is the reality, then everything else that we call the reality is unreal. And therefore, it is, you know, it behooves us to realize the absolute as real and everything else as unreal. This becomes the foundation of supracosmic theory as a yoga. The second one is the cosmic and terrestrial. And by that he means basically what we call in astrophysics the material universe. It's the terrestrial in that sense, that it is materialized, it is visible, it is experienceable through the external senses. Now the third one is the supraterrestrial or otherworldly. And this pertains to the notion of universes that are not materialized. In other words, that there are planes of consciousness and denizens of these planes that belong to the occult universal worlds. But there are such worlds. And then the fourth one is exactly where he comes up with the notion. So we can affirm that absolute. We can affirm the this worldly or cosmic and terrestrial, which is what science does. We can affirm the supraterrestrial or otherworldly, which is what all forms of occultism and religion do. And finally, he comes to the integral or synthetic or composite. And mind you, each of these terms means something different. The composite is like, we discussed this earlier, the composite is sort of like a mixture. It's like amalgam, where you have various kinds of elements that have been wrapped together to form a composition in which they coexist but retain their identities. The synthetic is that in which these elements have been subsumed into something which is no longer the same as what the constituents were, like a compound. But at the same time, what has been composed did not exist before. It has actually been created. It's a creation. And the integral is that which already exists in a sense as a unit. That is, the constituents actually are interrelated in an inextricable and indivisible manner, inseparable manner from their oneness. It is sort of like the oneness of the human being with its parts, with its body parts or its other psychological parts or whatever, which we may divide for the sake of our own division and our own handling, practical handling, but which we take for granted as a unit. So the integral is in that sense not synthesized, nor is the integral a composition. Okay, it's not composed in that sense. But these three, each one of them is a certain approach, one may say, depending on where we stand, on a certain interrelationship between the supracosmic, the cosmic and terrestrial, and the supraterrestrial or otherworldly. A certain view that is not happy with allowing each of these to remain independent and exclusive of the others. And so the point he's making is that let's look at each of these and let's probe them for the various, you know, positions that may exist in each of them that have been given to us by a variety of teachings, and we don't need to accept any of them. But we can look at what questions remain unanswered. We can test these against the intuitions and aspirations that we carry with ourselves. And then we can see where other things fit in. So this is really the tenor of this exploration so far. And where we are right now has to do with the extension of the idea of the supracosmic theory of existence. Now, before I continue to that last paragraph, which we read but did not discuss last time, I'd like to pause and see if there's any comments, questions, or any kinds of, you know, sort of reflections on what we what have talked about so far and what we've read so far. Yeah, here's Michael.
Okay, your last mention of the word aspiration triggered this question in my mind. That is, what if a person tells us, I don't want to be involved in the world. I really want to be in some sort of union with the absolute, whether it's whether I totally disappear or I have some identity. And you can go on with your, you know, your Earth and do whatever you want of it. I'm not saying we have to erase Earth, but this is my aspiration. Well, if somebody were to respond to that way to us, would we say that he's just not ready or that he's incorrect in some way? Or could he be just a question of his aspiration being different but not inferior to Sri Aurobindo's aspiration?
Yeah, I'd say you see, there's nothing which is wrong as such. I mean, there's no question of somebody's aspiration being inferior or superior. But what he's doing over here is more universal, not a kind of a sort of individual choice, because individual choices will always exist, and individual choices are always to be respected. But what he's saying over here is that let he who may consider with the full weight of consideration the various possibilities that exist. Let us not, due to our taste for a certain thing, jump to that particular conclusion about reality. If one, for a certain taste, chooses a certain version of reality, that is fine for that person. But is that something that answers to the universal need of humanity? Is there such a thing as a universal need of humanity? Now, we are left with two positions. One is that no, there isn't, that every individual is absolutely different, in some way unique, and therefore is justified in a variety of different positions in each of these kinds of theories that he's pointing. And the other would be that no, there is something which one can actually sort of sum up, just as he's talking about a kind of a composite, synthetic or integral view, as the integral view of humanity. Now, it's very interesting, because from a certain point of view, if he's making the point that our experience, the locus of our experience, the possibility of our experience as human beings, you know, extends to a certain kind of integrality where the indivisibility of being is experienceable by us as the absolute, the supracosmic, the cosmic and terrestrial, and the otherworldly or extraterrestrial. as an internal and a personal reality, that is, the human being itself is that, I am that, as they say in the Vedanta, then the point he's making is not so much whether somebody is interested in affirming a certain aspiration or other, but what is the scope of the human realization? This is all that he's putting down there. And it really isn't something that is meant to police anybody about what the scope of their experience ought to be, but actually to lay them down side by side as possibilities for, you know, human consumption, you may say. See from that point of view.
Deb, this is Rich. I have a question.
Yeah, Rich.
And it concerns these four integral theories.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if they at all correspond to these theories through four different epistemologies, or if we go back to chapter 10, the four different ways of knowing. I mean, do each of these worlds in some sense correspond at all to you know, each one of these different ways of knowing, which is knowledge by identity, knowledge by direct contact, knowledge by indirect contact, and separative knowledge. I mean, is there any correspondence at all between these various sort of ways of knowing and these theories he's putting forth as being four different versions of, you know, of integral theories?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I actually, honestly, I haven't thought about it that way. There would certainly be some sort of overlap, you know, because, yeah, evidently, if you're thinking about a kind of a theory of reality which affirms the cosmic and terrestrial, we are talking about a separative kind of knowledge.
Correct.
If you're affirming a reality which is extra cosmic and occult, we are talking about knowledge by inner contact.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about the experience of the supracosmic, we are talking about a knowledge by identity.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there is a certain kind of correlation between these forms of knowledge and these you know, theories of existence.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an integration of them, because the knowledge by identity actually subsumes, which is why when he begins with this supracosmic idea, he takes pains to assert the fact that supracosmic view of existence does not need to exclude the others. And, you know, I mean, all these forms of knowledge may coexist and be actually seen as formulations of the knowledge by identity.
Mm-hmm.
Specialized operations of knowledge by identity. This would also relate, in a sense, to the transformation of knowing, or the transformation of the mental functions and even the senses by a supramental, you know, transformation.
Mm-hmm.
This is Ron. May I make a comment?
Yes, Ron.
Rich used the phrase that this discussion is about four different types of integral theory. And my understanding, just going back to on page 667, is that the way that Sri Aurobindo put it is that this discussion is about, he says, four main theories or categories of theories, four different conceptions of truth or existence. And those are the supracosmic is number one, this number two is the cosmic and the terrestrial. Number three is the supraterrestrial, otherworldly. And then number four as a category is the set of integral or synthetic or composite theories. So that's only one of the four that we're here discussing. that hot category called interval. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, that's correct. I think that was probably a slip on Rich's part. Basically, the four, sort of theories of existence are those four. The fourth one being, as he's saying, and there too, he's not calling it an integral theory. As I pointed out, he's clubbing three kinds there. And even those three kinds really is a certain sort of perspective, depending on where you're looking at this indivisible reality, on whether it's composite or synthetic or integral.
Actually, also, the chapter itself, the integral knowledge in the aim of life, four theories of existence, it would seem that the four theories of existence themselves sort of make up this integral knowledge.
Yeah, the way he puts it over here in this paragraph, the fourth one is the integral one. But it's actually, again, is sort of a little bit of semantics because, you know, as he does in the synthesis of yoga, he introduces the four major yogas. But if you go through each of the yogas, you find that he kind of extends each yoga into an integral yoga. The yoga of knowledge is an integral yoga of knowledge. The yoga of works is an integral yoga of works. The yoga of love is an integral yoga of love, etc. So here too, one may say that these theories of existence, of which the fourth over here is being called the integral theory, will be to some sense viewable as each of them a certain kind of integral theory. In other words, even the supracosmic, the absolute, you see the root of the truth of the absolute or supracosmic theory of existence is that there is nothing but the absolute. And the absolute is the one thing there is. Parabrahman is absolute and there is nothing other than Parabrahman. Now this is true. And this is absolutely true. And so we may say that there is an integral way of understanding it. That's partly why Sri Aurobindo's philosophy is called Purnadvaita Vedanta, the Purna, the integral non-dualism. So the non-dual absolutism of this supracosmic view of existence is affirmed by Sri Aurobindo as an integral non-dualism. So too, if we look at the sort of cosmic and terrestrial, that too is affirmed. If you look at the chapter on matter, basically what he's saying is that the entire supracosmic reality is present in matter. Whatever we are calling matter are just properties of matter. What is matter? What is the truth of matter? The more we probe it, the more we find that the superconscient is expressing itself as something called matter, and more of it expresses itself. It's an ascending evolution. So too, the super-terrestrial or otherworldly can be seen in a similar way, that the gods and the demons and this entire, infrastructure of consciousness is also, in a sense, integral, that there is nothing but the absolute represented in these forms, and these forms themselves can be seen as the absolute. So, from a certain point of view, that integrality is present, and that's the hidden truth of these four theories of each of these four theories of existence, too.
Deb, you put that very beautifully. And especially, and to think of the four theories of existence as sort of fractals or sort of holographic sort of presencings each sort of individual parts in itself, but reflecting the whole, it's, very nicely put.
Yeah, true, absolutely. They are exactly something like that. Now, in this first part that we read, the supracosmic view of things, but before that, I'd just like to, because this has, in some sense, also there's been an ongoing, sort of dialogue with several people, and Rich and I have been involved in this, about this whole idea of an integral theory. And I'm just kind of, wondering and asking Rich about this, whether you know, this whole idea about the integral theory that he's presenting over here, you know, as qualified as a kind of a need derivative on the life impulse to realize or have a goal or aim which is sufficiently you know, whole, is something that you want to comment on.
Do you mean sort of this expression of the absolute sort of as it expresses itself through a will to life?
Yeah, and also, you see, because you see, when we talk about in the Western sort of idea, epistemology of theory, when we talk about theory, basically we are talking about arriving at a certain map of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that map of reality is an end to itself. That's why, you know, we make the distinction between pure knowledge and applied knowledge. And so, you know, it's a kind of a totalism. It's a totalitarian sort of scheme of knowledge, mm-hmm. where we are actually trying to set down in stone. And this relates also to what the question that Michael was asking. We're trying to set down in stone that this is the truth, and this is the truth that includes all other truths. It's an inclusivism, as one might call it.
Right.
So if there is a certain kind of, you know, integral theory that moves in that direction, as we know, there are certain dangers to it. Now, the point that one has to distinguish over here, which is what I think is important in this particular context, is that Sri Aurobindo is not interested in creating a certain kind of schema of that type for people to, you know, follow as a kind of a standalone goal of knowledge, but that a kind of testing of the boundaries of our experience and arriving at a kind of a theory of knowledge or a theory of reality that can allow for all the bound the sort of integral sort of realization, you may say, the integral yoga, you may say. The integral yoga, you may say, is the root of the integral theory. Without the integral yoga, there is no integral theory. And the integral theory has no reality in itself except as a kind of, you know, help, aid, or ultimately envisioning of the integral yoga. So that makes a very big difference between the standalone idea of an integral theory as practiced by various kinds of, you know, sort of academic, you know, sort of disciplines today, and what he's trying to kind of lay out the foundations for.
Right, because even it becomes... not even a theory. It manages to sort of open experience up, whereas integral theory, no matter sort of how inclusive it tends, it sort of idealizes its experience in certain directions. And what Sri Aurobindo is doing, as you actually beautifully laid out, is that implicitly in the entire multiplicity of experience of it's possible to sort of live in a reality where the knowing itself is expressed through the experience, and every individual sort of part or manifestation of the experience becomes an occasion that itself can presence the whole. And
right.
So you're not sort of building up a theory in itself. I mean, implicitly from the beginning, every sort of, you know, every spectrum, every slice, every sort of range of being is sort of validated as being, you know, sort of in itself
integral.
Integral.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. 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 Yes.
So I think this is sort of key. I mean, absolutely. You know, when sort of experience is and knowledge, it sort of when you construct an integral theory, basically you've created sort of a manifestation of information, and by virtue of its being, its bodying forth, its embodiment, sort of this, it becomes an integral yoga.
Yes.
And that's the spark, I believe, that sort of is must be implicit in any sort of, you know, any theorizing we do.
Right, right. So to move on where we are right now, in this he begins by presenting the supracosmic view of things, and he's drawing on the two major supracosmic philosophies of India and of the East, you may say, which are Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta. And then he's moving to an earlier Vedanta, as he calls it over here. And first he introduces the Buddhist view of the supracosmic reality as being something which goes so far beyond our notions of or our ability of experience that it is better to call it non-being. That's how he introduces that you know, to affirm it as any kind of being is already a certain kind of hubris of human experience, and therefore it is much better to give it the name non-being and to see everything else that we may experience phenomenologically as being part of that same non-being, in other words, non-existent. So that extinction of the self, extinction of consciousness, extinction of the ability to experience, is that self-annulment in the absolute, which can be the most extreme form of a theory or the practice of the theory of the supracosmic. So that's how he begins by talking about that particular position of the supracosmic theory. And then he goes on to talk about the Vedantic, but with Advaitic Vedantics, and he says, this ideal of a self-extinction, which is boldly and clearly proclaimed by the Buddhists, is in Vedantic thought a self-finding. But the self-finding of the individual by his growth into his true being in the absolute would only be possible if both are interrelated realities. And this is how he prods or kind of, you know, sort of pokes the foundations, the experiential foundations of these theories. Basically, he's saying that, you know, the Advaita Vedanta, which is talking about a self-affirmation and a disappearance of the self in the true self, is in some sense basing itself on a relationship between these two selves. Without that relationship, it's not possible to have a growth into the infinite. And so, if they are interrelated realities, then, as he's saying, it could not apply to the final world-abolishing self-affirmation of the absolute in an unreal or temporary individual by the annulment of the false personal being and by the destruction of all individual and cosmic existence for that individual consciousness. However much these errors may go on, helplessly inevitable in the world of ignorance permitted by the absolute in an universal, eternal and indestructible avidya. So here he's saying that basically that if both are interrelated realities, then that affirms the cosmos and the individual in a way in which it is not, you know, sort of mandatory for us to affirm the other kind of exclusiveness, the exclusiveness of Advaita, in which all cosmos and individuality disappear and only a supracosmic being remains. See, so here are the two positions, but in claiming those two positions, he's already introduced a third and a more integral one, which is a integrality of the absolute in which the interrelationship between the individual and the absolute is affirmed. And therefore, the individual is seen as nothing other than a self, you know, sort of figuring of the absolute. And then, having touched on that, the last paragraph that we did, he then moves to another position in this supracosmic theory. And that position is a older Vedantic position, the position of the Upanishads. Now, this is a very interesting one, because in a way, Sri Aurobindo is also, while affirming the oldest Indian scriptures, also challenging certain assumptions within them. And as he's pointing out here, I mean, to summarize, he's saying that whether you look at the Upanishads or even the Isha Upanishad, which in some sense forms the foundation of the life divine, or if you look at the Gita, which Sri Aurobindo extensively commented on, or you look at the ideal of Jivan Mukti, which is the older Upanishadic ideal, there is a question that is left unanswered in all these. And the question is, what is the meaning of becoming? And what is the meaning of being individual? Is there any meaning to these things? Now, the answer that is given is a little hazy. You see, because what is given is, and some of the phrases he uses in this last paragraph refer to that. Because, you see, the answer that is given, you may say, Krishna says it to Arjuna. The Isha Upanishad says it in its own way. And the Gita actually takes it, I believe, from the Isha Upanishad. You know, Krishna says, go forth, fight, live 100 years and enjoy a righteous kingdom. See, the Isha Upanishad says the very same thing. It says, live for 100 years and enjoy the becoming. Okay, enjoy the existence in life. Now, this is what he's referring to as in the Vedanta of the Upanishads, the becoming of Brahman is accepted as a reality. There is room, therefore, for a truth of the becoming. There is in that truth a right law of life. That right law of life leads to dharma, which is what the whole Mahabharata and the Gita is all about. It is what asking the question, the whole of the Gita and the whole of the Mahabharata is really based around asking the question, what is dharma? A permissible satisfaction of the hedonistic element in our being. Its delight of temporal existence, an effective utilization of its practical energy, of the executive force of consciousness in it. But the truth and law of its temporal becoming once fulfilled, the soul has to turn back to its final self-realizing. For its natural highest fulfillment is a release, a liberation into its original being, its eternal self, its timeless reality. In other words, and as he goes on in this paragraph, we see what he's saying is that out of its self-delight, being represents itself as a becoming. As what kind of becoming? There is only one truth to that becoming. That is the truth of its oneness. The truth of its oneness is also known as dharma. Dharma dynamically uniting the entire becoming is what makes for what he calls the right law of life. In other words, if we can come in tune with this dynamic principle of oneness, with the fact that whatever is becoming is ultimately one being that and one becoming, then our actions, our movements are those that enter into an enjoyment, which is the enjoyment of the one being. See? The one enjoyer, bhokta. So that particular kind of hedonistic impulse, you know, you see the two very fundamental sort of, you know, desires or aspirations that become the cornerstones of Vedantic theory or Vedantic questioning, you may say. One of them is the aspiration to be free, to be liberated from the prison house of existence. It sees, it views the becoming as a prison house. But the other one is, or as you pointed out earlier, a madhouse. That is a variant of that. And the other one is to arrive at the enjoyment of this enjoyable becoming. That's the hedonistic impulse. So how to arrive at a sorrowless enjoyment, as in an enjoyment that does not bring as its natural corresponding experience its own opposite of pain. And that is the way to do it. That's the whole teaching that Krishna is giving to Arjuna, is in that there is no stain of karma that will come upon you if you act within dharma. That if you act in unity with the one being, knowing that it is the one becoming, then you get obliterated in that action of the one being. And so, in a sense, this becomes a kind of, you know, enjoyment of the becoming and in the becoming, and a experience of the delight of being in the becoming. Now, this far, it is a life-affirming Vedanta that Sri Aurobindo is talking about. And that is the reason why he takes pains to open up the whole interpretation of the Isha Upanishad and the Gita in these terms. But at the same time, he is pointing to an insufficiency in this theorizing as well. And that insufficiency is that even if we may say that out of a kind of intrinsic delight, being becomes, there is no further, you know, sort of outcome to this becoming. He's saying that being becomes in a kind of blind sort of repetition of the cycles of becoming, the coilings and uncoilings, the vast, uncoiling of an insignificant spiral amid the vast circlings of the eternal's becoming in the universe. The insignificant spiral, of course, is the human existence. And the point he's making over here is that in this theory, there is no weight given to the hinge of the individual, which ultimately is necessary if we are to give any affirmation to an evolutionary destiny to this particular becoming. Is this becoming meaningful? If it is meaningful, then what is the meaning of that becoming? That meaning can show itself to us as a certain kind of a graduation. That's the term he uses elsewhere in the chapter, the divine and the undivine. And that graduation, this gradual extension of consciousness, hinges on the individual for its fulcrum, turning it around and making it conscious. Okay? Mm-hmm. So this is part, in a sense, of another kind of, you know, view which is missed, whether in the Vedanta or in the Gita, and not sufficiently given importance to. And the point he's making here is that even if we may say that the enjoyment of the becoming is desirable because it is life-affirming and we don't need to escape from life, we can experience the becoming as nothing other than the delight of being, yet that does not have any intrinsic meaning to it or value to it. It's without any value. Its values are only relative. And as he says, temporary buildings. And then, what happens then to the question of the individual? And he's saying that is a question, a very valid and important question in philosophy that we cannot wish away. We cannot wish away because it presents itself to us repeatedly, and that's how he sort of presents this whole life divine from the beginning, by what he calls the human aspiration, that we cannot wish away certain things that repeat again and again, in spite of all obscurations in our deepest intuitions and aspirations. And this is one of them. The value put on individual perfection and salvation is too great to be dismissed as a device for a minor operation. Coiling and uncoiling of an insignificant spiral amid the vast circlings of the eternals becoming in the universe.
So is that value, is it a hint towards evolution?
Yes, absolutely. If the becoming has got some truth to its reality as a becoming, not just a truth of the fundamental act of delight becoming, but a truth to the goal of becoming, then what becomes has certain kind of valuations to it that point to that goal. But otherwise, these are very, very relative, and values can't really have any kind of absolute significance in a becoming that is just a kind of a blind expression of the delight of being. The question from Michael.
Actually, it's going to be in the form of a comment, which will lead to many times I heard that the kind of position that there really hasn't been any progress in philosophy. It's only been progress in technology in the last 4,000 years. In other words, we don't act more ethically than the Greeks or the nobles or something like that from the 16th century or something. And we don't have better manners or whatever and treat each other well and so forth. So if that were to be, but we're persisting for 4,000 years, more or less, the common person, he says, yeah, I see what you mean. We haven't really learned and taught ourselves really how to be better people. We've done a lot of progress in the last 200 years in materialism. Until Sri Aurobindo talks about the life divine. Before that, I feel that perhaps it was right to say, well, there'll never be in a million years any great change. There will always be fighting with each other and wars and arguing with each other, but we'll have, all these conveniences. But with Sri Aurobindo, he's talking about life divine, he's talking about a type of evolution that we didn't see before. A lot of times our strong philosophies were like sort of super cosmic, like Plato and Christ and so forth. They're sort of like emphasis on the otherworldly. So, in a sense, one could have accepted that this was a bit of nonsense to enjoy and then to return as you really become adult to the supercosmic. And I think Sri Aurobindo is of course, we know it's tremendous, but in a sense, without him, those concepts of this is just in that important place to enjoy for a while, to grow a little bit, and then to think about return to a higher plane would have made a lot more sense, be more convincing until Sri Aurobindo comes with the life divine and shows the full scope of what the evolution might be.
What you say has some ground. But let's sort of look at it like this, that, what the human being could have been and whether the human being could have changed or not is really a kind of a matter of a kind of the ground of what one might call a world discourse, Yeah, that's the point. I mean, in a sense, we are in a world which has partly consciously and partly accidentally accepted a certain positive goal for all of humanity, which is technological goal, if you want to call it that. The goal of material convenience, right? Now, that particular goal develops itself in time through a variety of mechanisms, not all of them glorious, but very, very much having to do with the suppression of alternate life goals. In a sense, would other people have come up with other kinds of possibilities of being human and of exceeding the human if, for example, this particular, you know, hegemonic worldview had not, you know, become so dominant, yeah, over the last 500 years. Now, you may say if you go back, you know, and start looking at the genealogy of Sri Aurobindo, in a sense, I mean, even whether he knew it or not is another matter, he did know it to some extent. He's using a word Superman, which has been coined, and he's aware of it, by Nietzsche. So if we do go back and look at the ideas that have come to us, even from as far back as Nietzsche's time in the modern age, we find that alternate attribute for making another kind of human, for exceeding the human, that is the Superman, that's the Nietzschean Superman. And after Nietzsche, the term is not really used because it's too big a word. It's too kind of hubristic, you know, it's too over-glorified for the human without knowing what it means. And therefore, but the preoccupation of philosophy after Nietzsche, one may say, has skirted around this issue. If you look at it today and really kind of look at it in its connections with what, you know, has been presented by Nietzsche, we find that without mentioning it, philosophers have been fascinated by the idea. And it's in a sense with Sri Aurobindo, we find arriving somewhat from original sort of sources and somewhat from traditional sources, both Eastern and Western, he has the boldness to present this kind of alternate direction for the human and its transcendence. Now, the transcendence of the human, the death of the human, you may say, you know, the sort of, you know, the end of time, is not something that is sort of, you know, new to Sri Aurobindo. The idea has been floating around. Even the Enlightenment philosophers themselves have, to some extent, predicted it, you know. But their understanding of it has been stymied. It has been sort of, you know, kind of, I mean, distorted and mistaken by the whole notion of the human being limited by mind. And it's only here that drawing on a kind of a, you know, another definition of experience of the human as the transitional being and as somebody who can experience consciousness in ways other than the mind, that we find this full-blown, you may say, voicing of a kind of a world discourse, of the possibility of a world discourse that is fully alternate to the teleology of materialism.
So, Debashita, this is Alopa. I have a question.
Yes.
In the Vedas and in the Gita or Upanishads, when they are extolling upon the individual to progress, is that not enough? Like, you just said that Sri Aurobindo has brought in this new idea of the individual. But don't we see it in these texts also?
Yeah, we do, Lopa, but you see, the thing is that the becoming, the progress of the individual, the question is, where does it lead? What is the meaning of progress? See, that is where the whole thing hinges. In today's world, you go out on the street and tell somebody, you know, you believe in progress, and they'll pat you on the back because they also believe in progress. But what is the progress that they believe in? That's the whole question. What is the meaning of progress? That becomes the big question. So without laying a foundation where the becoming has itself a kind of validity of progress, a progress in representing you know, more and more of the integrality of conscious being, we can formulate progress as a kind of a further and further, you know, sort of development towards the extinction of me, or towards the, you know, the kind of realization of the true delight of being and becoming, but a delight that is satisfied without any kind of transformative impulse. See? So progress in and by itself, without having any kind of content to it, is ambiguous.
Oh, I see. So the next stage from the human, the Superman stage, is something completely new that was not there in previous philosophies, whether Eastern or Western.
I wouldn't say necessarily that, because, you know, I mean, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that the Vedas are talking about it. But it's very recondite, esoteric in the Vedas. It takes his whole new symbology to bring it to light. In the Upanishads also, it is not necessarily, you know, absent. It may be present, but it is not foregrounded. All the major, even the older Upanishads, I mean, the really old Upanishads, like the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya, have a lot to them that is very, very esoteric and actually relate to the Veda. But, you know, the Isha is one which really affirms both being and becoming, okay? But it doesn't go that one step further to give meaning to becoming as a kind of, you know, progressive or graded manifestation of conscious being. It gives meaning to the human existence within the becoming. And it doesn't affirm the destiny of the human either as a universal species or as an individual whose sort of participation becomes critical in that, you know, sort of turning of the consciousness or turning of the prakriti, of the consciousness of nature from its, you know, sort of lower Maya, you know, reality to its higher Maya reality.
Okay, and the passage that is in the Veda, the discourse between Indra and Agastya, so does that,
yes,
give a hint that the cosmic power is hinging on the individual progress to take him along?
Yes, of course it does. Very much so it does. But it's look at that particular hymn, and hymns of that kind, they're so esoteric. They're so, you know, they're so cryptic. And, you know, what they mean, you know, it's almost like Sri Aurobindo's record of yoga. You know, it's so cryptic that nobody has been able to decipher it until and unless they have actually embarked upon the path themselves and have seen that goal and then shed that light upon that particular hymn. And this is what Sri Aurobindo has done. And that's why, in a sense, you know, this whole idea about darshan and yoga, that, you know, until and unless you lay the foundations of the proper, you know, scope of a yoga with a proper hypothesis, then you will get stopped somewhere. But if you lay it right, then you progress to a point where things start getting illuminated, and at that point it is possible to arrive at what one might call an integral theory. But that integral theory is really a ontology, it's really a phenomenology. In other words, it is a kind of a seeing, it is a darshan that results from a yoga.
Namaste, Devashishji. This is Saroja.
Yes, sir.
I have actually a comment plus a question. We are talking about individual progress here, but talking about the synthesis of yoga, there we talk about collective or community level progress or consciousness, development of the consciousness. One individual to progress or move from one stage to the next stage,
I kind of understood from the chapter 2 of the synthesis of yoga there, we discussed that the collective consciousness development is required, and without that one cannot progress or proceed further. Is that understanding wrong, or how does that relate with this context of individual progress, what she
No, of course it's not wrong. But you see, in this particular paragraph that we just read, he is actually showing one certain position of the supracosmic theory, as he calls it. And in that position, he's pointing out that we have various kinds of teachings in which becoming has been given a validity. But that validity is one of a representation of the delight of being. Being helplessly, in a sense, expresses itself or expresses its delight as becoming. That expression may, manifest a word and then may sort of retract that word, collapse that word, you know. But at the same time, it cannot but express that word once again. And that is the eternal truth of a becoming. Now, that particular view of this earlier Vedanta, as he talks about it, is a kind of life-affirming view. But even that view does not give sufficient place to the individual, to the weight of the individual, the transcendent that resides in the individual, not merely as a potential of realization, but a potential of transformation. Not merely as a potential of the transformation of the individual, but as a potential for the transformation of the cosmos. Now, the individual and the universal, or the individual and the collective dimension comes in because he's not, in this particular paragraph at least, laying that much emphasis on the universal dimension of the becoming. That is, as I was saying, that the becoming is not merely a kind of a blind expression of the delight of being, but a kind of a purposive manifestation of gradations of being, of gradations of consciousness. If we consider that, then we have a right to consider a universal dimension to the importance of the human as well. Now, this importance of the individual, if the importance of the individual has a universal dimension to it, then we see that it is through a collectivization of the individual progress that universal realization can take place. Not only is the realization of the supracosmic a individual possibility, but it is also a universal possibility. These are the three terms. The individual, the universal, and the transcendent. So this supracosmic absolute transcendent has become this universe and has become this individual. These are two terms that are, you may say, conterminous in terms of representing the absolute. The individual is not less than the universe as a representation of the supracosmic. That is part of its, you know, the fractal nature of its integrality. Okay, so, but it is also a kind of a portion of the universal. It is greater than the universal as well as a portion of the universal. In the dimension of its being a portion of the universal lies the universal realization, the realization of the universal becoming occurs through the development of a species level sort of manifestation of consciousness that is a knowledge by identity. And that can only come about through a process of a collective yoga, you may say. But the first and foremost prerequisite for that is for the transcendent to be realized by the individual. A collective yoga cannot fulfill itself without an individual realization. Thank you.
So can we think of this theory as the bridge between the individual and the cosmic?
Which theory, Siddhant?
The theory that basically the
integral theory that he's talking about. See, in this particular one that we've so far read about the supracosmic, he has presented three major positions. One is the position of Buddhism, second is the position of Advaita Vedanta, and third is the position of the older Upanishadic, or the position of the Gita, you may say. And in each case, he has actually prodded it to some extent to kind of release certain sorts of, you know, inconclusive or insufficient, you know, sort of voices, you may say. And he's going to draw on those and on other such insufficiencies later to build this, what he's calling this integral theory. Now, in this, what he has done so far, you may say that he's on the way towards presenting that particular kind of thing, which is what you're calling the bridge. The bridge between the individual, the cosmic, and the transcendent.
Debashisda, in the previous chapter, we had read about the sevenfold ignorance and the seven knowledges. So I was thinking of, for example, this extreme view, the Buddhist view. So even if they may realize that there are these ignorances, they may not realize that you need to correct those ignorances. It is enough to know the absolute and not have to strive to know every other, the six other ignorances. Is that correct?
Yes, very, very true. Very true. Yes, that is why he's laid out that ground of the sevenfold ignorance. Because again, that is a step towards establishing the various kinds of insufficiencies that we are kind of presented with in our experience as human beings, and which, without solving all of which or finding some kind of reality in which all of them are sort of answered, not piecemeal, but all at once, as it were, that is the meaning of integrality. There is a certain insufficiency that will persist. And so even the highest, what he calls the original ignorance, may be answered. But if that answer does not include the solution to all the other forms of ignorance, then it is not the adequate answer. Because as he's saying, that the original ignorance, if answered, should be able to answer all the other ignorances.
So I suppose it's not wholly answered, it is just partially answered, and then the escape route is taken.
Yes.
Yeah, and the other philosophies like Keval Advaita and the Gita philosophy, they would perhaps answer more of the ignorances, but not simultaneously or holistically.
Right. So in a sense, actually, you know, it's very, very interesting to consider the method of the Life Divine as a form of philosophy, because it is a very unique and original form of philosophy. In a sense, it resembles many other forms of philosophy, and yet it escapes from all these forms, you know, by kind of, you know, being somewhat different, unique and original, see? It draws on the, you know, the sort of the logical content of the later philosophies of India, as well as of Western speculative metaphysics, in a sense that it spells out a variety of positions, and of, you know, not only that these are positions in mind, but these are also positions of history, also positions of culture. And at the same time, there is a certain kind of appeal to an older form of philosophy, which one might call the pre-Socratic philosophy of Greece, or of the metaphysical philosophies of India, as in the Vedanta, where there is a certain kind of constant probing of experience, of whether it is valid to arrive at certain conclusions, not merely because they are logical, but because they illuminate certain aspects of not that common experience of human beings. So there is a combination of these two that, in one may say, in a sense, is neither Eastern nor Western, neither fully Vedantic nor, you know, sort of, I mean, kind of Western in the sense of, you know, metaphysical, and at the same time includes these and charts its own kind of course. That is, you know, in a sense, Sri Aurobindo's own sort of integral methodology.
Yeah, but it is interesting that he didn't write the book in the order we get it.
Yeah, yes. But nevertheless, he put it together. That's why it's kind of, yeah. But this is the wonderful thing about the work, because it's, again, you know, the integrality of it is there, that as you read it, whether you read the first book or the first, you know, part of the second book or the second part of the second book or each chapter, in a sense, you know, the overarching unity of the whole thing is present in each of these.
Devashish, I can say Sri Aurobindo's reading, I mean, his text is fractal itself. I mean, sometimes just in paragraphs, I mean, everything is, you know, revealed.
Exactly.
And it's
exactly
like that over and over, it keeps fractaling, you know, down.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think itself is, the text itself is integral.
Yes.
Shall we move on to the next paragraph?
Okay, I think we should read the next paragraph, yes. And then, you know, maybe, you know, just say a few words and then move on. I mean, then call it a day for today.
Meera, can you read?
Yeah, I'll read. The cosmic terrestrial view, which we may take next, as the exact opposite of the supracosmic, considers cosmic existence as real. It goes farther and accepts it as the only reality. And its view is confined, ordinarily, to life in the material universe. God, if God exists, is an eternal becoming. Or if God does not exist, then nature, whatever view we may take of nature, whether we regard it as a play of force with matter, or a great cosmic life, or even admit a universal impersonal mind in life and matter, is a perennial becoming. Earth is the field, or it is one of the temporary fields. Man is the highest possible form, or only one of the temporary forms of the becoming. Man individually may be altogether mortal. Mankind also may survive only for a certain short period of the Earth's existence. Earth itself may bear life only for a rather longer period of its duration in the solar system. That system may itself one day come to an end, or at least cease to be an active or productive factor in the becoming. The universe we live in may itself dissolve or contract again into the seed state of its energy. But the principle of becoming is eternal, or at least as eternal as anything can be in the obscure ambiguity of existence. It is indeed possible to suppose a persistence of man, the individual, as a psychic entity in time, a continuous terrestrial or cosmic and souling or reincarnation without any afterlife or other life elsewhere. In that case, one may either suppose an ideal of constantly increasing perfection, or approach to perfection, or a growth towards an enduring felicity somewhere in the universe as the aim of this endless becoming. But in an extreme terrestrial view, this is with difficulty tenable. Certain speculations of human thought have tended in this direction, but they have not taken a substantial body. A perpetual persistence in the becoming is usually associated with the acceptance of a greater supraterrestrial existence.
So here, before, you know, we can kind of revisit this next time in greater detail, but just as in the previous, few paragraphs, in the consideration of the supracosmic, he has made the absolute into the exclusive reality, and as an exclusive reality, everything else is secondary and derived from it, and derived to the point of extinction. Derivative to the point of non-necessity, and therefore ultimately to the sort of extinction. Here, what is affirmed is material existence. But by material existence, he does not mean necessarily only what is material, but only what is experienced in matter. So a kind of a terrestrial experience of reality. That is, that this world or this universe as we know it, and our existence and the existence of whatever consciousness may be present, as bounded by this material existence. This becomes the truth of an exclusive cosmic terrestrial view. And he's looking at this, you know, even in this small paragraph, from a variety of different kind of cultural vectors, you may say, partly scientific, partly derived from Greek ideas of the, you know, transmigration of souls, and partly, sort of opening up certain speculations of progress. But then he will, as we see, keep the attention focused on the primacy of the cosmic terrestrial reality. Anything supraterrestrial or anything other, you know, extraterrestrial is given one, what one might say, a kind of a secondary derived or illusionary reality, just as in the supracosmic, these other realities are given a derived or ultimately illusionary reality. So over here, this is what the focus will be. And based on that, it's like saying that if this is the real view of reality, we can explain whatever the other experiences we may have, including the reality of experiences of consciousness, without bringing into our explanation either the supracosmic or the extracosmic. We'll explain all these things only in terms of the cosmic terrestrial. So that is the going to be the you know view of reality that he will present in the next few paragraphs.